We have Mr. Scott McEwen.
Good morning. There has been a theme woven into the fabric of many of the messages this feast here in Oceanside. It has shown up in songs and certainly in many of Mr. Weber's comments. And it's fitting and appropriate that on this day designated as Family Day during the feast, that we would explore this subject in more detail. The subject of today's message and the title is We Are Family. Take a look around the room here. Take a look around the room and take a look at your family. We use a term in the church that you would very rarely hear in any other context, and that term is brethren. What does brethren mean? Brethren means plural for brothers. And as the Bible tends to be gender neutral in many ways, we can apply that in the broader context to brothers and sisters. And I think we can take enough license to say that it means all family. So as we hear that term brethren, we can think that means all of us as family. So the implication is we're all family, and today we're going to explore this concept and see how it applies to all of us here at the feast. So we could look up the definition of family, and some of those definitions would be fairly obvious, but we'll take a look at a couple that we can think about how they apply to us. One definition is descendants of a common progenitor. Does that apply to us? Well, in the 6,000-year history of humankind, we could go back to Adam and say, certainly. There was another bottleneck at Noah, so we're all descendants of Noah as well, so we could apply that. Of common lineage is another. There's a term known as apostolic succession, and that term applies to us in many ways as well, in that the reason that we're all family is because we all have something in common. We have God's Holy Spirit. And how and when did you receive that Holy Spirit? It was in a ceremony, likely immediately preceded by baptism, where a minister or ministers said a prayer and laid hands on you and asked for God's Holy Spirit to combine with the human spirit that you have. Those hands that were laid upon you were laid upon you by men who had hands laid upon them. By men who had hands laid upon them, going all the way back to the apostles. Thus the term apostolic succession. The Catholics are very careful to record this, and they trace their history and heritage back to Peter, the Orthodox back to Paul. We as a church understand that that was the same succession that applies to us. Another definition is a group of people who are generally not blood relations, but share common attitudes, interests, goals, etc. There's no doubt that applies to us. That is why we are here. We all have that same number one goal, and that is to seek the days that these days represent, seek the time that these days represent here at the feast. We are here because we are invited to be a part of the family of God. It was a personal invitation. No one can come to God unless He calls them and draws them. And we were here because we responded to that call, or because our parents or grandparents did, and we were given that blessing as a result as well. In fact, family is the very analogy that God gives us to help us understand His plan. He is God, our Father, and Christ is our elder brother, and we are all brothers and sisters and future heirs. Let's turn to Romans 8:14. Romans Romans 8:14 says, "For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God." So again, sons and daughters. And then in verse 16, "The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ." We are going to inherit all of these things that God has in store for us. What a wonderful opportunity that is. And that's what we come together during these days to think about and to try to comprehend and to taste just a little bit of what those blessings and that amazing future is going to be like. We come here to be with other members of the family. As we come here, we look around, and we are blessed here in Oceanside, California, with 700 plus to be, if not the largest, one of the largest gatherings of God's people anywhere on earth. We have a big family reunion going on right here. And what an awesome opportunity that is. We come to get our batteries charged from each other, because we go back to smaller areas. We go back to work or school where we may be the only one that we know of that knows about God's way of life and God's truth. And we come and get our batteries charged at this family reunion, knowing that there's so many other people in their respective places of business, of school, of work, of home, doing the same thing. Satan is working hard to destroy this family. Why? In every good mystery, it's fun to try to determine the motive. And once you determine the motive, it helps to solve the mystery. What is Satan's motive for wanting to destroy this family? Let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 13 says, "But to which of the angels has he ever said, 'Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool'?" And then it says, "Are they not, they, the angels, not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister to those who will inherit salvation?" We know that it's us that will inherit salvation. Thus, and all of those who choose to respond to God when they have the opportunity to know the truth. And the angels are Satan, or we know who the angels are, and Lucifer was one of those angels. And we're not sure when God's plan was revealed to the angels, but it's very likely that at the time that Lucifer learned that all of these humans were going to someday outrank him, he became upset about that. And now we see motive. Why does he want to destroy this family so bad? Because he knows what his future looks like. He knows that his days of influence are going to be over soon. It's the days that the Feast of Tabernacles represents. His days of influence are going to be over, so in the end he loses. But how can he still win? He can take as many of us with him as possible. And he will never stop trying. So we are commanded to assemble for that reason. Animals, we look at all the different animals here. Many of them prey animals. I think a little monkey snuck up here on stage, on the podium. Do animals tend to isolate themselves? Most prey animals do not. They understand that there's safety in numbers. And we can read an analogy about Satan in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. 1 Peter 5:8 says, "Be sober, be serious, be vigilant. Because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. So he's looking for those who become separated and fragmented. And he goes not after the strong. Even lions don't do that. You don't see the king male lion saying, "Look at that big, strong wildebeest. Watch this. I'm going to go right into the middle of all those wildebeests and take out the biggest, strongest one." The lions don't even do that. Nor do lions want to be separated from their pride, because lions on their own are vulnerable to, say, hyenas in that. So there's safety in numbers, and there's something very special about being together and being a part of a family. So let's now talk about family problems. Does our family have problems? Every family has problems. Every family has problems. If the family has problems, does that mean that God is no longer with the family? Well, let's go back in history. Let's think of a few stories that the Bible has to share with us. Abraham was chosen by God to be the father of his nation. Did Abraham's family have problems? It certainly did. Over time, there was problems with Hagar and Sarah and Ishmael and Isaac. Jacob and Esau, they had their problems. David and Absalom. Any relationship with humans is going to have problems. I was told once that no relationship I will ever be in will be perfect because I am in it. And I think that's true of all of us. We're not perfect beings. We don't act perfectly, and that has its consequences. Why would it appear as though this family seems to have so many problems? Perhaps it seems like others don't have the same level of problems that we do. Well, I heard it said, and I think this is a nice analogy, that United Church of God is the biggest piece of flotsam from the wreckage that was once the Worldwide Church of God. And it's very possible that that's true. And as a result, as the biggest group holding together, does that attract the attention of Satan? Absolutely. He wants that fragmented for the reasons we've previously discussed. So we shouldn't be surprised about this. Let's turn over to Matthew 5. Sometimes it helps when you go to the dentist, and while you may wonder if your dentist is any good when they tell you that this is going to hurt, and it's going to hurt for several weeks, and you'll be sensitive, and the list goes on of problems that you may have. But then when you experience them, you think, oh wait, this is supposed to happen. They told me that this would happen. Matthew 5:11 does something for us in a similar way. It says, "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake." It has to be falsely for us to be blessed. Important note there. "Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So if we face problems, we know that those who have gone before us have faced problems as well. John 15:20 records Christ's own words. In red letters it says here, "Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they would keep yours also." But of course, they didn't, and they killed him. So we hear from Christ himself that we can expect this. You know, we can see that others who are easily recognizable, the Jews being the most recognizable one of the tribes, that were the tribes of Israel, have faced persecution throughout their generations. The nation of Israel itself is surrounded by nations that wish it were gone and will do everything they can to wipe it off the face of the earth. So they have faced adversity, and it has galvanized them as a people, and it can us as well, because we understand that we all face these similar things. So how should this family dynamic work for us? This is and should be a safe place for you. And I say this meaning the church. It should be a place to learn and a place to grow. This environment in the camp setting is known as the zone. And in the church setting, it's very similar as well. It's a place to learn. We all have something very special in common. We talked about having our goals in common, this knowledge, and we all want to know more about this way of life. I appreciate that many men have spoken already this feast with 40, 50 years worth of feasts, festivals under their belt, 50 years of keeping God's way of law, and they say that they are here to learn, as they have every year that they've come to the feast. We want to learn more about this way, and we want to pass it on. We want to pass on this way of life and this truth. Let's turn over to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6, verse 6, says, "And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart." The Bible refers to the heart as the core motivation of a person. Verse 7 of Deuteronomy 6, "You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way, when you lie down and when you rise up." Now, in this context, children can be applied to the niños, those 2 to 20, let's say, the children. But I think it could be applied in a broader context as well, because many of you, as we found out the first day, the first service, are here for the very first time. And so there's children and there's newcomers to this way of life. And the opportunity that we have at the feast is to talk as we talk and as we walk and as we share meals together and share services together. This is a place to learn and grow. And your stories are important to pass on. I think of one of the most poignant examples of stories that really connect with people new in the church are those about tithing. We've had conversations, and I remember as a young man first tithing and the miracles that came immediately following my putting of that money in the envelope. And many will come in and say, "I have no idea how I can do this. You know, our budget is this, our expenses are this, and it just doesn't quite cover it now. And when you start cutting away at that, I don't know how it works." Well, I don't know how it will work for you either. But I can tell you this. I can tell you this story, or you can tell your story and say, "This is how it worked out for me, and I did not see this coming." And very likely, in short time, they will have their own story to pass on as well. And I've seen that happen multiple times, but there's just an example of how your stories and your conversations about how God has blessed you and worked with you in your life can really mean something to somebody else who is starting to make their choice now, whether it be a young person or somebody new here for the first time or in their first few years. So we think about passing it on to those new as well as to the children. Hebrews 5:12, we won't turn to, but there's an implication there that there is a time for milk and a time for meat. Mr. Weber encouraged me to put a little plug in for the young adults Bible study, so this is when we will do that. Those fundamental doctrines that immediately follow Hebrews 5:12 are what we will be discussing in the young adults Bible study Wednesday night. So I hope to see many of you there from 18 up to whatever a young adult is. Now, we hope to have you there Wednesday, I believe it's at 7:30, to discuss these fundamental doctrines. The church is also a place to grow. This family is a place where we grow. We have a chance to serve. We've heard sermons and messages about that. You find a place to serve, you see a need, and you fill it. Or you're recruited into a position, and you respond. So it's a place to learn, it's a place to grow, and it's also a place to teach. Because all of us are somewhere on our continuum of learning, and we make progress, and we continue to learn, and we continue to make progress. And as we do, then we also have the ability to teach those who are learning and progressing at a different place. And there's an expectation that we are both learning and teaching. In fact, they say that camp is as much for the staff as it is for the campers, and perhaps more so. That speaking is as much for the speaker as it is for the listeners, because it forces someone to study a subject and to learn it. And there's no better way to learn something than to have to teach it. When you know that you're going to have to teach it, you're really paying attention. You dig a little deeper. And we have that opportunity in church, in spokesman's clubs, in youth lessons, at summer camps, at church services. The list goes on of opportunities and places we have to teach as well. It's a great place to be mentored and to seek mentoring. There's many people that have characteristics that we can look to and want to emulate and get to develop a relationship with them. We can ask them perhaps how they developed that trait, and we can spend time with them and see how they respond to certain situations. We can talk to them and learn how they think. It's a great opportunity that we have in this context of the greater family. And it's a place to mentor others as well. In fact, it's possible that it's commanded. James 4:17, turn over to James 4:17. James 4:17 says, "Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin." We don't want to become apathetic. The world has in many cases become sort of calloused and apathetic. And I'll define apathy as a state of indifference or suppression of emotions, such as concern, excitement, motivation, and love. We would not want to suppress those feelings or those emotions, would we? In fact, the Bible suggests that we do just the opposite. And as we think now about the responsibilities that we have to each other as a family, we will move to love. As a family, do we have responsibilities to each other and responsibilities in this family? Absolutely. What family is there where somebody does all the work and maybe the kids just live a resort lifestyle where mom gets up, makes breakfast, and gets them going, and they're off to school, and then goes and makes the bed and all of that? Perhaps that happens in some cases, but the reality is, in a family setting, everybody gets responsibilities usually. Somebody's supposed to feed the dog and take care of the dog, and somebody's supposed to take care of the kitchen, and somebody's supposed to help with the laundry perhaps, and go out and work and trim up the yard and keep the yard looking nice. There should be responsibilities distributed in that way. And so, kids, I'll tell you that you're not being abused if you have these responsibilities. My son, I think, was pretty sure that he lived at a labor camp. And one time we were out in the yard, and as the song leader indicated, it's warm in Arizona, and it was warm this day, but we're trimming up the bushes and the trees and cleaning up, and my son says, "Dad, when you were a kid, did you have to do all of these things around your house?" I said, "Yes, I did. I had to do all of this." "Is there anything that I have to do that you didn't have to do?" "No, nothing I can think of." And he says, "Okay." And he got back to work. I just think he wanted to make sure that he wasn't being abused somehow or didn't actually live in a labor camp. Let's turn over to John 13:35. John 13:35, again, is in red letters. This is Christ telling us what our responsibility to each other is. Sorry, 13:34. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. Now we can go to 1 Corinthians 13 and read a definition of love. Multifacets of that definition. But here Christ says, as I have loved you. And how far was he willing to go for us? That you also love one another. And by this will all men know that you are my disciples if you love one another. That's how Christ will know and God will know who are theirs when they return, is by whether or not we have followed this commandment. Now, many of you are in school now, and likely all of you have been in school at some point. And every instructor tends to have some way of indicating something that you will need to know. Many times they'll knock on the podium, and that's kind of a tick saying, pay attention to whatever comes next because it will be on the test. We get a little indication about what's going to be on the test when Christ returns here. And Matthew 24:46 says that when Christ returns, he wants to find us so doing. So doing what? Let's turn over to Matthew 25, verse 31. Matthew 25, verse 31 says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, he will sit on the throne, and he will gather the nations before him, and he will start to separate them to the right and to the left. And those that cared for each other, looked after the needs of others, cared for the sick, visited those in prison, those are the ones that he's going to set on one side. Whereas those that were indifferent, we defined apathetic earlier, apathetic, would have done it for Christ, but didn't necessarily care to do it for the people. He says, we just don't have a place for you. We're looking for those that look after the needs of others. So this is going to be on the test. He tells us that here. We should pray for one another. A responsibility that we have to the family is to pray for one another. We can read that in James 5:13. James 5:13. Is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing psalms. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of the faith will save the sick, and the Lord will raise him up. It says, confess your trespasses to one another. If you're struggling with something, it may help to talk about it with somebody, and then they can pray for you. Prayer for somebody is a pretty intimate part of a relationship. When you pray for somebody, it really indicates that you care for them. And there's an implication there that you know what's going on in their life as well. And how do you find out what's going on in their life? How do you find out what you should pray about? There has to be conversation. There has to be a relationship developed. So we should be developing meaningful relationships with each other so that we can do this, so that we can fulfill this. We also have a responsibility to each other to hold each other accountable. It says here that we confess. Why would we confess to somebody something that we're struggling with or going through? We would do that so that when we see them next, they might ask about it and we have a level of accountability. AA knows the power of a group. You go to a meeting and you say, I've done this for this long. And there's accountability in that. Because if you slipped, well then, this long wouldn't be as long as it was. And they reward and recognize that. And that's something that we should do as well. We should acknowledge growth and success for each other. It's a wonderful part of being a family, that others care when something goes well. Sing psalms when things are going well. That's what James tells us here. Accountability applies in other ways. Let's think about the marriage ceremony for a moment. Now, the bride and groom get up there, and certainly there's a minister that's performing the ceremony, but who else is there? They're best friends, right? Probably, but also witnesses. They are witnesses. And as you go to that wedding, you are also witnesses. Why? You're there to see them make that commitment to each other, and then you are the accountability for them as well. There's an accountability then that as they have made those, not a secret, but publicly made those vows, that they adhere to them. And we have that same level of commitment when we make the choice to become baptized and members of God's family, and we receive that Holy Spirit. And so that accountability works very well in that case as well. We teach each other. We talked about mentoring earlier. Let's turn over to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2 gives us some encouragement here. It says, this letter to Titus says, in starting in verse 1, "But as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine, that the older men be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience." Those are characteristics that men should develop and have. And that the older women, likewise, that they have these same characteristics. That they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, and that they pass that on. And that they admonish the young women to love their husbands and to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed, so that they pass on these lessons that they have learned to younger women, and that they develop that relationship. And it's saying here that that relationship is important, and that the older women may have an ability to understand what the younger women are going through, and that through this relationship, both may benefit. So that's a great opportunity. We talked about James 4:17. To not do this would be a big mistake, and it would be a lost and wasted opportunity. So that's the ladies. Now let's turn to the men. We have a problem in society. And that is that as Satan, who is very good at what he does, has worked hard to destroy the family. And he has specifically attacked the male role. And so there is a missing link in the education process that should be occurring from men to their young men, to their boys, and passing it on. And so as that has been broken down, we as a society see and suffer through many of the consequences as a result. Rick Johnson, in his book, Better Dads and Stronger Sons, states that boys need men to teach them how to be men. He uses men in the plural sense because fathers are definitely designed to play this role. Proverbs 17:6 says, "The glory of children is their father." And that's true. And so to fathers, I'll say this. You know your shortcomings. And you may feel like, I just don't measure up to who I should be. But to your children, you do. And you matter. And your influence is important. You're their dad no matter what. Absolutely no matter what. This relationship is one of those things that's going to be restored in the days that this Feast of Tabernacles represents. Malachi 4 says this in verses 4 through 6. It says that God is going to restore this relationship of the fathers and the children to their fathers. But for now, as this role has been decimated, we all need to be aware of how we may be able to play a role in helping others and to be mentored ourselves. I'd like to say that stepfathers play an incredibly important role in this capacity. And perhaps the role of a stepfather is one of the most selfless roles in existence. We can think that Christ himself was raised by a stepfather. And that is the role of a stepfather, someone raising and helping to guide and direct someone else's children. There's a country song that shows respect and appreciation to this role. And one of the lines in this song says, "Someday I hope I am half the man you didn't have to be." As this artist thinks through the role that his stepfather played in his life, and he's going through his different life events, and he keeps coming back to the fact that he hopes he's half the man his stepfather didn't have to be. Every boy can use many mentors. In fact, that is the way that we learn. Boys learn to control their strength and their power from other men. It's been said that humility comes from being in the presence of those more competent than you. And so in the younger roles, many times boys or young teenagers, they get this through sports or athletics. Later, it's more in intellectual capacities or in leadership roles. And as you work with others that are more competent than you, you sometimes realize at different phases in life that perhaps you are the dumbest guy in the room, and that maybe it would be good to be quiet and listen to what the other men have to say. And that's a great opportunity. And that's how we learn from each other. We also see the consequences of this in society as boys learn to control certain things from other men. Anger is the one emotion that young men are not afraid of. And so we see this anger expressed in gangs and that sort of thing. How to be a man is to do something violent, or that's the initiation into this. But the mark of excellence for men, as we think through this term, we think that it's really not expressing emotions and anger and power. In fact, what do we call a man who we see as one who expresses these characteristics of that which we would admire? We call him a gentle man. I can look out in this room and see many men that I have learned from and continue to learn from, and that I respect and I appreciate aspects about them, and I try to emulate those characteristics and aspect in my life. I'm very thankful for the opportunity that I have had with many of you to spend time together in camp settings or in other opportunities where we have to spend time together and practice living this way of life that God has given us. It's been wonderful. And now I have opportunity to see many of you grow up into young adults and become accomplished yourselves as you finish your educations, you get jobs, you get married, you commit to this way of life. It's exciting to see. I can't even tell you how fulfilling that is. And now I want you to feel the weight of responsibility to pass that on to my kids. I hope that my boys learn from you young men. I hope that my daughter can learn from you young ladies. And I hope that we continue to pass this on and that you stay true to this way of life that you've been exposed to and that you pass it on to the next generation. I'm going to read an article in conclusion here that I think really captures the essence of the message today. It was printed in the United News in July 2010. Perhaps some of you know the author and the subject of this article. But it was in the Treasure Digest, and it's entitled, "It Takes a Church to Raise a Godly Child." It says, there's an old African proverb that says, "It takes a village to raise a child." With the graduation of our oldest child from high school this year, I have been thinking about all of the help and support that we have had from our church village in raising him. While I firmly believe that it is the parent's job to raise a child, the church family provides help and support that is extremely beneficial and can greatly enrich the life of a child. Over the years, my husband and I have experienced that support in so many ways. For instance, neither my husband nor I have any special mechanical or technological abilities. Yet a man in our congregation noticed that our son had a keen interest in these things and spent time answering questions and chatting with him about computers, technology, and building things like a hovercraft. When Luke was about 12, this man asked me if he could give Luke an old computer taken apart along with a book, which would give him a chance to learn how to build a computer. We would have never thought of this ourselves. We readily agreed. Who could know that all of these strange pieces in plastic bags could produce a computer? But Luke was fascinated by this challenge, and it took him only 1 week during his summer vacation to put together a working computer. He has gone on to learn much more about microelectronics and technology at school and on his own, and we have all benefited from the skills learned and the interest started from that project. You may never know what a difference getting to know a young person and sharing an interest of yours could make in the life of that youth. The article concludes by saying, as Luke heads towards college and adulthood, we would like to thank the many people who have been instrumental in helping him grow into a young man. We encourage all of you to continue to be involved with the youth that you encounter at services. It is truly a way to fulfill John 13:35 in the lives of our children. As you get to know the youth and build a friendship and relationship, you may have the opportunity to have a profound impact on a future member of the God family. We have a responsibility towards each other as a family. We have a work to be doing, and it's for others, and it's for each other. Let's not allow Satan to distract us from the task of building this family. Let's not allow him to distract us from our duties. As we consider on this family day during the Feast of Tabernacles, let's remember that we are family.